Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one on your phone to ask a question. I would like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may. I will now turn today's call over to Jason McDonell. Thank you, sir. You may begin.
Thank you, Denise, and thank you to all who have joined us today for today's COVID-19 update. We are joined by CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky and Dr. Christy Clark. Dr. Walensky will provide opening remarks, followed by Dr. Clark, who will give an overview of a new report being released today in CDC's MMWR. After remarks, Dr. Walensky, Dr. Clark, and Dr. Meyer will be happy to take your questions. This is an on-the-record briefing and embargoed until 1 p.m. Eastern. At this time, I will turn the call over to Dr. Walensky.
Thank you, Jason, and good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining this call. Today, I'll start by giving you an update on the state of the pandemic and then turn it over to Dr. Christy Clark, who will provide some details on a report we are releasing in the MMWR today. Overall, we continue to have some mixed trends. As seen on slide one, deaths, fortunately, are continuing to trend downward with a 7-day average of about 300 per day, which represents an estimated 18% decline from the prior week. Hospital admissions also remain low at about 1,600 per day, but we should note that for the second week in a row, they are slowly trending upwards, an increase of about 9% this week from the prior week. Cases also remain comparatively low to where we were even a month ago at about 44,000 per day, though this too has represented an increase of about 25% in the past week. We are aware that many are using rapid antigen tests that may not be reflected in the total daily case counts. Our data show that we are still doing over 650,000 PCR tests daily. And while this is about a five-fold reduction in PCR testing than was done during the Omicron peak in January and February, we are now recording 70-fold fewer cases, suggesting that our reported case counts do reflect a true and reliable drop in our overall cases. We're, of course, continuing to follow trends in positive PCR tests and have also looked at data on a selected share of rapid tests. The trends are largely similar, and we continue to believe that our PCR testing data, especially when we corroborate it with information from our other surveillance systems, like wastewater surveillance and emergency department and hospital surveillance, provide us a reliable picture of the trajectory of COVID-19 across our country. Last Thursday, CDC updated COVID-19 community levels, shown on slide two. I'd like to call your attention to upstate New York and the Northeast region, where we have an increased number of cases and hospitalizations. The counties in orange, or high COVID-19 community level, reflect just a small subset of counties and of the United States population, but these are areas where CDC recommends people should wear a mask in public indoor settings due to an increasing level of severe disease and the potential for significant healthcare strain. Similarly, the counties in yellow or medium, many of which are in the Northeast and Puerto Rico, are areas to watch carefully and where those who are immunocompromised or at risk of severe disease might consider wearing a mask in public indoor settings and where screening, testing, and other prevention strategies may be implemented at the individual or community level. I want to move now to slide three and the latest on our genomic surveillance of variants and their lineages and sublineages. We're sequencing thousands of viruses per week through our national SARS-CoV-2 strain surveillance and contracts with diagnostic and sequencing groups across the country to understand what is out there in the United States. Essentially, 100% of what we're finding now is Omicron, though different lineages or sublineages may be more common in each region. This means that if a new variant were starting to spread, we would identify it quickly. As a reminder, it was the BA1 Omicron subvariant that caused the surge early in the year. Right now, BA1 is only about 3% of the sequences identified. We are now more commonly finding the BA2 Omicron subvariant, which makes up about 68% of circulating virus. More recently, we're finding the BA2.1.2.1 subvariant, which was first identified in upstate New York and which makes up nearly 30% of sequences identified nationally. We're just starting to learn about the impact of BA2121. It appears it might have a transmission advantage of about 25% over the BA2 subvariant. Additional evaluation is currently underway to understand the impact of BA2121 on vaccine effectiveness. But importantly, we continue to believe that those who are vaccinated, and especially those who are boosted, continue to have strong protection against severe disease, even from BA2121. Today, CDC will release a report in the MMWR that looks at the proportion of the United States population with infection-induced antibodies. And we're fortunate to have with us on this call Dr. Clark, the lead author of that study, to answer your specific questions about those data. Before we take your questions, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Clark to say a few words about the study and its key findings. Thank you, Dr. Clark.
Thank you, Dr. Walensky. Good to be with you all. Today, we will release a report in the MMWR that looks at the percentage of the U.S. population with evidence of prior infection with SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. This study was conducted on clinical blood samples from all parts of the country and looked at the percentage of the U.S. population that developed antibodies to the nucleocapsid protein. This antibody develops in response to infection from SARS-CoV-2, but not in response to vaccination. By February 2022, evidence of previous COVID-19 infections substantially increased among every age group compared especially to December 2021. And this is a period where we would expect to see it reflecting the increase in cases that we noted as Omicron surged in this country. The highest jump of antibody detection was among children and adolescents. Now, overall, between December 2021 and February 2022, seroprevalence, in other words, the presence of antibodies to the virus in the bloodstream, increased across all U.S. age groups from 34% in December 2021 to 58% in February 2022. Again, this study was only looking at the presence of antibodies from prior infection and did not detect antibodies from prior vaccination, whether it be primary series or boosting. The largest increases were observed, as I mentioned, among children and teens, those 17 and younger, of whom by February 2022, roughly 75%, or 3 in 4, had developed antibodies due to prior infection. Having infection-induced antibodies does not necessarily mean you are protected against future infection. We measured the proportion of the population with any detectable level of these antibodies, and this type of antibody stays positive for at least 2 years after infection. We did not look at whether people had a level of antibodies from prior infection that provides protection against reinfection or severe disease. Previous infection has been shown to provide some protection against severe disease and hospitalization. And vaccination, either before or after infection, provides additional protection. Additionally, we still do not know how long infection-induced immunity will last, and we cannot know from the study, again, whether all the people who tested positive for SARS-CoV-2 antibodies continue to have protection from their prior infection. What we do know is that vaccination is a safe and effective way to get robust immune protection for a specific amount of time. CDC continues to encourage all Americans to stay up to date with their COVID-19 vaccinations. And while those who are under the age of 5 are not yet eligible for vaccination, the best way to protect them is to make sure that they are surrounded by people who are taking preventive measures like staying up to date with their vaccines. With that, I'd like to turn it back to Jason for any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Clark. Denise, we'll start with our first question. For the reporters on the phone, we will do one question and one follow-up. Let's go ahead.
Thank you. The first question comes from Erica Edwards with NBC News. Your line is open.
Hey, thank you so much for doing this briefing and for taking our questions. You know, clearly you're seeing this dramatic increase in kids with COVID. Given what we know about increasingly contagious subvariants, and the fact that the youngest children do not have access to the vaccines, are you concerned that these subvariants will continue to plow through, you know, these most vulnerable pediatric populations, perhaps leading to long-term consequences? And I'm also curious, really, how parents should interpret this study. Should they bother getting vaccines for kids who are eligible given this high seroprevalence? Thank you.
Dr. Quack, you want to take that question? Oh, of course. Thank you so much for that question, Erica. So there are a couple of aspects to your question. First, you talked about the increased seroprevalence among children, which was quite striking over this Omicron time period. And I think that some of the important things to note here are that these findings in seroprevalence reflect some of the things that we saw in terms of clinically and through our other surveillance systems during Omicron, where during the Omicron wave compared to Delta, peak hospitalization among kids was 2.9 times higher, with ICU admission rates 1.4 times higher, and five-time increase in the hospitalization rates among kids aged 0 to 4. But at the same time, there was no difference in the proportion of those hospitalizations where the primary reason for admission was COVID-19. So this really reinforces some of our previous findings. And then to your second point regarding parents, now I'm a pediatrician, and I've talked to a lot of parents who, you know, have questions about vaccination over the years. And the first thing I always do is just to listen to them. I know they're coming from a place of wanting to make the absolute best decision for their child. I have a four-year-old myself, and I have in common with every parent everywhere, I just want my kid to grow up happy and healthy. And so after, you know, hearing their concerns, and I could see that some people would wonder with this high seroprevalence regarding vaccination. So that's why I want to be really specific in responding to this question. So first of all, in kids, COVID can certainly be quite severe. We see, you know, if among those are hospitalized, 20 to 30% going to the ICU, and that's especially among our population of very important population of kids with special health care needs. And then multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children, that happens 60 to 70% of the time in previously healthy kids. We also know that post-COVID conditions can occur. And so there is evidence that all of these outcomes can help to be protected by vaccination. And we also know that there is an impact of vaccine among those who are previously infected in terms of a subsequent infection leading to hospitalization. Another important thing to consider is that when we see a new variant like we did with Omicron, that is when we start to see more cases of reinfection. And so when you're looking at whether to vaccinate a child, you need to also think about giving them broad protection. And so not just to, you know, infection might have had with Omicron, but also to the vaccine. It really maximizes the protection to their kids. So overall, we know SARS-CoV-2 infection can cause severe disease, whereas COVID-19 vaccination is safe and effective at preventing it. So as a pediatrician and a parent, I would absolutely continue to endorse that the children get vaccinated, even if they have been previously infected.
Next question.
Next question is from Lena Sun with the Washington Post. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking the question and for doing the briefing. Either Dr. Walensky or Dr. Clark, could you perhaps, for the general public, and also my editor, explain what is the takeaway, what is the significance of knowing that nearly 60% of the American population have these antibodies? It means that there was a previous infection What does that mean? Does it just reinforce what we know? Does it tell us that more people were infected than we previously knew? And also, not just for the kids, but a lot of adults, as you know, don't want to do any more mitigation measures or even get vaccinated. And would they interpret this to mean we don't need to bother because we already have natural immunity?
Hi there. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for that question. So in terms of what this means, it's it's important to look at all of the different ways that we can track COVID-19. And we know that the reported cases are just the tip of the iceberg. We all know that there are some infections that go unreported, either because they're, you know, asymptomatic, mild, the person didn't get tested or it didn't get reported. So seroprevalence is an important piece of the puzzle, and it helps us to really understand more kind of the public health picture for COVID-19. And then, in terms of what this means in terms of infection rates, we have done another study, which will be released in preprint soon, where we look at the number of estimated infections per reported case. And we know that that is going up, and that now there are a bit over three estimated infections for each reported case, which is the highest level that it's been. So that's why this is sort of an important part of the puzzle in terms of contextualizing our case data. If you're asking a second part of your question, I believe was regarding kind of some thoughts about no need to continue to take measures because of high population level seroprevalence. So it's important to note that there's, first of all, this could not be accurately understood as the proportion of people who have protection against reinfection. We know that that is not what this means. Reinfection happens, and infection after vaccination can happen. And protection from vaccination and protection from previous infection do wane over time. There's also no known threshold of the population where once we get above X percentage, we'll completely stop community transmission of SARS-CoV-2. So all of that is really important to know. And in terms of, you know, maybe adults who have been infected and may not, you know, have been infected, I think it's important to, you know, reference the recent MMWR by Xi that among adults with previous infection, vaccine added protection against a reinfection that would lead to hospitalization. We want to keep all people in our country as healthy and safe as possible, so it is important for, you know, either adults or children who have been previously infected to get vaccinated if eligible.
Okay, so could I just add with a follow-up?
Go ahead, Lena.
Sorry. So is this 60%, is this more or less than you previously thought?
That's an interesting question. I definitely expected that we were going to see an increase continue. We had 43% in January, and I did expect it to increase. I didn't expect it to increase quite this much, but we follow the data and we look at the data, and this is what the evidence is showing us. And so this is why we wanted to get this message out to the U.S. population as soon as possible. This is the first time that population seroprevalence is over 50%.
Next question.
That comes from Mike Stobie with Associated Press. Your line is open.
Thank you for taking my question, and thank you for doing this briefing. Could you repeat, Dr. Clark, did you say that just the limitations of this, detectable levels of antibodies, you could detect them for up to 2 years? I mean, like if someone was infected in early 2020, would they have enough antibodies in their blood that it would have been detected here, or is this really just a snapshot of the last year? I'm just wondering if there are any limitations about that. And could you just speak plainly to the public about just simple explainer, why infections were more common in kids and adolescents? Why was it 75% in them but just 33% in people 65 and older? Why the difference among the ages? Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Mike, for that question. So it seems like the first part of your question was regarding the length of time for which people have this type of detection on this test. So we use, for this specific study, a type of test that detects antinucleocapsid antibodies, but detects a very low level of antinucleocapsid antibodies. It also gives us a yes or no answer. Either the antibodies are detectable or they're not. And so we do know that this
test will be positive in someone who has been previously infected for at least 1 to 2 years after infection. And so this is a good measure of what proportion of our population has been previously infected, but not a good measure of what is the, we don't know the level of antibodies that, each person has with this particular type of test. Now, in the future, with this surveillance system, we are moving to also including a quantitative test, and we'll be looking forward to doing more work on the amount of antibody and how long that takes to wane and other additional things that are important at this stage in the pandemic. There are a couple of limitations here. First of all, this type of methodology cannot detect reinfections, and there's some emerging data that suggests that infection after vaccination might be less likely to result in detectable antibodies, so we'll continue to follow those data, and we'll also continue to advance on our work to use some quantitative tests, or in other words, tests that give us, a number in terms of the precise level of antibodies. And I think there was another aspect to your question, which I may be slipping. Did I get every point?
Yeah. I mean, even if it's well known to you, could you explain to me and the readers why the infection, why the prevalence was so much more common in adolescents and kids, 75% compared to 33% in people who are retirement age?
Sure, absolutely. So one of the important things that we saw in the study was that the greatest increases in seroprevalence over this time period occurred in age groups with the lowest vaccination coverage. So the proportion of the population that was fully vaccinated by April 2022, it increased with age, whereas, our seroprevalence decreased with age. Now, some of that may also be due to, in some of the older adults, they may be more conservative in terms of, or more consistent in terms of using other preventive measures. Over.
Next question.
Up next is Spencer Kimball with CNBC. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for doing the call. My question is, what does this potentially mean anything for the future trajectory of the pandemic? In other words, so we know now that 58% of people have antibodies against COVID. There's also a lot of vaccination out there in the population. So can we expect to see a lower burden of severe illness, at least as long as, the circulating variants are still within the Omicron family moving forward?
Yeah, thank you, Spencer. Maybe I'll start with that one and say, this is among the reasons why we rolled out our COVID-19 community levels, because we do believe that there is a lot of protection in the community, both from vaccination as well as from boosting and from prior infection. That said, I can't underscore enough what Dr. Clark said, which is those who have detectable antibody from prior infection, we still continue to encourage them to get vaccinated. We don't know how long when that infection was. We don't know whether that protection has waned. We don't know as much about that level of protection than we do about the protection we get from both vaccines and boosters. And Dr. Clark.
Yeah, another thing that I think is important to keep in mind here is that we know that the Omicron surge in cases came at a time of high population seroprevalence with anti-spike antibody, which we saw in our blood donor seroprevalence study, which you also can see on COVID Data Tracker. So we do know that reinfections happen, as does infection in people who have been vaccinated. We know that from other studies that vaccination, including booster doses, offer added protection against severe disease, including that caused by Omicron. But, I think it's important to take into consideration that when we saw a new variant, even in the context of that higher seroprevalence, we still saw an increase in cases. And so that's important in terms of thinking forward.
Next question.
Next question is from Cheryl Stolberg with the New York Times. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for doing this call and taking my question. This is for Dr. Walensky. Based on what you've learned about case rates and transmission over the last 2 weeks, would you be recommending dropping the mask mandate if it was still in place today, the transportation mandate?
Thank you, Cheryl. Maybe I'll just back up a little bit and say that although the mask requirement is not in effect, and we were, of course, disappointed by the ruling this past week, I want to just emphasize that CDC continues to recommend that people wear masks in all public indoor transportation settings. We've said before, wearing a mask is most beneficial in crowded or poorly ventilated locations. Many of those are in our travel corridors, like buses, busy subway trains, jetways on airplanes, and in the airport. When we know that when people wear a well-fitting mask over their nose or mouth, and or when they wear a respirator, that they protect themselves and they protect those around them. Of course, as you noted, we are continuing to closely follow cases, hospitalizations, our COVID-19 community levels, but we fully intend to continue our recommendations right now that people wear masks in public indoor settings. Thank you.
And just a quick follow, you had extended it until May 3rd, which is a week from today, I believe. Will you be making any announcement on May 3rd about whether you are going to recommend continuing masking or whether you would recommend dropping masking?
Cheryl, we're having those conversations right now, and of course they have legal implications as well. But what I do want to emphasize is, regardless of, maybe I'll just say we're continuing to have those conversations now, but I do want to re-articulate that we can also continue to recommend masking in public indoor settings, and I don't expect that to change.
Next question.
That comes from John Wolfolk with San Jose Mercury News. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you, if you could hear me. Just to clarify, you were just saying a moment ago that you're continuing to recommend masking in public indoor settings. Is that did you just mean in the transportation setting, or is that because that seems to be contrary to what the guidance has been for 98% of the country that isn't having hospital pressure? And my main question was just if you could tell us what we're supposed to make of the obviously rising cases, some uptick in hospitalizations. We now have this new study indicating that half or more of the country has been infected and has some protection for that. Is that, do we have a wall of immunity and we don't have to worry or about the rise in cases, or is that not known?
John, maybe I'll just take the first part really clearly and say my response to Cheryl in the prior question was all about transportation settings. If that wasn't clear, it was all about transportation settings. So we at CDC continue to recommend that people wear masks in all indoor public transportation settings. with regard to your question about, where are we in this moment, I think, there are some areas in the country, particularly in the Northeast, where we're seeing a higher number of cases, and we're starting to see some hospitalizations tick up. We're watching this carefully. We haven't seen them tick up as much as we might have expected in prior times during this pandemic, thanks to, I believe, a large amount of protection in the community, both from disease, as Dr. Clark and infection, as Dr. Clark has articulated, as well as vaccine protection. But this is something that we need to watch carefully, and we also are looking at not just the hospitalizations, but the character of those hospitalizations. We're seeing less oxygen use, less ICU stays, and we haven't fortunately seen any increase in deaths associated with them. So we are hopeful that positive trends will continue, that we will not see, as a result of these increasing cases, any further severity of disease. And in places that we do, we are, again, recommending that people follow our instruction from our COVID-19 community levels, that if they are in orange, that people mask in public indoor settings, and if they are yellow, that people take extra precautions as well. Thank you.
Next question.
Next question is from Marie Rosenthal with Infectious Disease Special Edition. Your line is open.
Thank you for taking my questions. I have two, but they're related. Are you seeing a difference in severity of disease from the different Omicron subvariants? And do does natural immunity development depend on the severity of disease?
I'm sorry, we had a very hard time understanding that because you were breaking up. Can you try again?
Oh, I'm sorry. Sure. Hold on a second. I'm going to... The first one is, are you seeing a difference in the severity of disease from the different Omicron subvariants? Does it matter which subvariant you get, how sick you become? And secondly, does natural immunity development depend on how sick you are?
Maybe I'll take the first and Dr. Clark can take the second. We are starting to study now BA.2.1.2.1 as well as BA.2. What I can tell you is the original Omicron variant has demonstrated decreased severity as we saw from prior variants that we've had here in the United States, what I call this decoupling of cases and severe disease. Now, there was a lot of it, and so that, of course, is what worked to overwhelm many of our hospital systems and lead to deaths. But case for case, it generally was less severe. We now are collecting data from places that had an initial surge of BA.2 as well as BA.2.1.2.1 on severity of disease. Epidemiologically, it doesn't appear as if we're seeing more severe disease in places that are having more cases. So we are not anticipating more severe disease from some of these subvariants, but we are actively studying it.
Dr. Clark did not hear the second question. Are you still there?
I have muted her line. Would you like me to open it back up?
Yeah, so we can hear the second part again.
I'm sorry.
Was this regarding, I just want to make sure I understood the question before I answer, but was this regarding antibody levels and severity of disease?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. thanks. Just wanted to make sure I was focusing on what you're looking for here. So, so more severe disease is associated with higher antibodies, which may be associated with higher protection. However, people with risk factors for disease are at increased risk for severe disease from reinfection. So all of that is important to keep in mind and just reinforces the message that for all people it's important for folks to, not think that because they've been infected they can skip vaccination or boosters. We encourage people to stay up to date completely on their vaccination regardless of their history of infection.
Next question.
That is from Alexander Tin with CBS. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. For Dr. Clark, can you just follow up on something you mentioned earlier? You said that there was an estimate of the kind of true count of total cases from seropositivity. Can you tell us more about that forthcoming estimate? And then Dr. Walensky, just to follow up on an earlier answer, can you tell us more about kind of travel masking? It sounded earlier like there was a framework coming. Is that still the plan, and what did you mean by framework? Thanks so much.
Hi. Thanks so much, Alexander. So in terms of the emerging study, so we have a study that's going to be coming out in preprint within the next couple of days where we looked at, for each reported case, how many estimated infections based on our seroprevalence data does that represent? So we refer to those as infection-to-case ratios. And what we found was that this varies over time. We looked at it over various time periods depending on the amount of transmission that was going on as well as the predominant variant. And we did find that there tend to be more in infections for each reported case during times of increased transmission. And we also found that now, this was a period that covered December, January, February, so that kind of the Omicron period, we found that over that time period, the infection to case ratio was the highest that it's been at over 3 estimated infections per reported case. And that varied by region. So depending on which U.S. Census region, the estimates were, the ratios were higher or lower. There is a previous study that was published in Open Foreign Infectious Diseases
that showed also an increased ratio of estimated infections per reported case among the pediatric population as compared to the all-ages population. So that's also something to keep in mind in the context of these data.
And to your other question, Alexander, maybe I'll just give you a sense of some of the things that we're looking at, especially in our travel corridors, which I feel like are characteristically different than because of the international component. So we are, of course, looking at our COVID-19 community levels, where we are as a nation in terms of how we're doing in terms of cases and certainly severe disease. We're looking not just at the absolute numbers, but also the trends in those numbers. We also, because of the international nature of specifically air travel, we're looking at whether there's other variants that are emerging around the world, whether other places around the world are having challenges with variants of interest or variants of concern, new or novel emerging variants. And then, of course, we have a stellar team of epidemic modelers, and we're looking at the anticipated forecasts of where we might be in the future. So many things are going to come into our decision as to our recommendations for indoor public transportation masking. Thanks.
Next question.
Next question is from Julie Steenhuisen with Reuters. Your line is open.
Thanks for taking my call. I know that you've hit on this a couple of times. I just really want to understand it. But, you know, based on what we're seeing in the slide on the increase in cases, it looks like cases are up 22.7% over the past 7 days. Deaths fell by 13.2%. And then we have this overlaying seroprevalence data, which is now rising. Help us to understand, is that a reflection of the higher seroprevalence within the population? I know that your study didn't look at levels of antibodies, but, you know, I mean, do you think it's more related to the severity of illness caused by the virus, or are we seeing some benefit from a large proportion of people in the United States with prior infections to COVID? Thanks.
Thanks, Julie. Maybe I'll start and just sort of say that the data that you see on slide one are data that are pretty well up to date to the minute, to the day. And the data that Dr. Clark has reported are antibody data that are ended essentially February of 2022. So it is essentially a look backwards as to how much disease or infection that we have seen historically. So I think that if we wanted to understand where we are today, we would look at, you know, the data on slide one. If we want to understand where we are sort of in the milieu of how many people have been seeing previous disease in the country, and then we layer on top of that previous vaccination and previous boosters, this gives us both a nice window of cases we might have missed historically, but also how much population immunity is out there.
Operator, we have time for more questions.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry, sir, one more time.
We have time for two more questions.
Thank you. And the next question comes from Drew Armstrong with Bloomberg News. Your line is open.
Hi. I have one quick technical question and then an actual one. Can you guys, this is for Dr. Clark, could you tell us exactly what the survey period was on this on the February seroprevalence? And then another technical question, the antibody detection time frame, you mentioned that it's about 1 to 2 years. Is that time frame because that is how long we have had these COVID antibodies to test for, or is that kind of a standard thing for a test like this?
Thanks so much for that question, Drew. So your first question regarding the surveillance period, so for this February data collection period, the data were collected over the period, I believe, from January 27th to February 26th. There were 18 jurisdictions in which the data collection period was less than 2 weeks, and there are correspondingly slightly lower sample sizes for those jurisdictions. We're posting the data on COVID Data Tracker today with specific asterisks on those dates. You'll be able to see the exact data collection dates as well as sample sizes for.
Thank you for calling the Digital Replay Service.